what it's worth. We had Not Fade Away, Walking the Dog, Round and Round, and I'm a King Bee. Sometimes chief constables would devise these ridiculous plans. I remember once in Chester, after a show that had ended in a riot, following the chief constable of Chester Police over the rooftops of Chester City, as in some weird Walt Disney film, with the rest of the band behind me, and him in full uniform with a constable at his side. And then he loses his fucking way, and we're perched on top of Chester City, while his great Escape from Colditz plan disintegrates. Then it starts to rain. It was like something out of Mary Poppins. The uniform with the baton, the whole bit. And this was his great master plan. In those days, at my age, you thought the cops knew how to deal with everything. You were supposed to believe that. But you soon realized that these guys had never dealt with anything like this. It was as new to them as it was to us. We're all babes in the wood here. We used to play Popeye the Sailor Man some nights, and the audience didn't know any different because they couldn't hear us. So they weren't reacting to the music. The beat, maybe, because you'd always hear the drums, just the rhythm, but the rest of it, no. You couldn't hear the voices. You couldn't hear the guitars. Totally out of the question. What they were reacting to was being in this enclosed space with us. This illusion. Me, Mick, and Brian. The music might be the trigger, but the bullet, nobody knows what that is. Usually it was harmless for them, though not always for us. Amongst the many thousands, a few did get hurt, and a few died. Some chick, third balcony up, flung herself off, and severely hurt the person she landed on underneath, and she herself broke her neck and died. Now and again, shit happened. But the limp and fainted bodies going by us after the first 10 minutes of playing, that happened every night. Or sometimes they'd stack them up on the side of the stage because there were so many of them. It was like the Western Front. And it got nasty in the provinces, new territory for us. Hamilton in Scotland, just outside of Glasgow. They put a chicken wire fence in front of us because of the sharpened pennies and beer bottles they flung at us. The guys didn't like the chicks screaming at us. They had dogs parading inside the wire. The wire mesh was quite common in certain areas, especially around Glasgow at that time. But it was nothing new. You could see the same thing going on in clubs in the South, the Midwest. Midnight Hour, Mr. Wilson Pickett. His stage set consisted of a rack of shotguns this side and a rack of shotguns that side. And the shotguns weren't there as props. They were loaded. Probably with rock salt, no heavy-duty stuff. But to look at it was enough to put anybody off throwing things at the stage or going berserk. It was just a measure of control. One night, somewhere up north, it could have been York, could have been anywhere. Our strategy was to stay behind in the theater for a couple of hours and have dinner there, just wait for everybody to go to bed and then leave. And I remember walking back out onto the stage after the show, and they'd cleaned up all of the underwear and everything. And there was one old janitor, night watchman, and he said, "Very good show. Not a dry seat in the house." Maybe it happened to Frank Sinatra, Elvis Presley. I don't think it had ever reached the extremes it got to around the Beatles and the Stones' time, at least in England. It was like somebody had pulled a plug somewhere. The 50s chicks being brought up all very jolly hockey sticks, and then somewhere, there seemed to be a moment when they just decided they wanted to let themselves go. The opportunity arose for them to do that, and who's going to stop them? It was all dripping with sexual lust, though they didn't know what to do about it. But suddenly, you're on the end of it. It's a frenzy. Once it's let out, it's an incredible force. You stood as much chance in a fucking river full of piranhas. They were beyond what they wanted to be. They'd lost themselves. These chicks were coming out there bleeding, clothes torn off, pissed panties, and you took that for granted every night. That was the gig. It could have been anybody, quite honestly. They didn't give a shit that I was trying to be a blues player. For a guy like Bill Perks, when suddenly there it is in front of you. It's unbelievable. We caught him in the coal pile with a chick, somewhere in Sheffield or Nottingham. They looked like something out of Oliver Twist. Bill, we've got to go. It was Stu that found him. What are you going to do at that age when most of the teenage population of everywhere has decided you're it? The incoming was incredible. 6 months ago, I couldn't get laid. I'd have had to pay for it. 1 minute, no chick in the world. No fucking way. And they're going, la 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 la. And the next day, they're sniffing around. And you're going, wow. When I changed from Old Spice to Habit Rouge, things definitely got better. So what is it they want? Fame? The money? Or is it for real? And of course, when you've not had much chance with beautiful women, you start to get suspicious. I've been saved by chicks more times than by guys. Sometimes just that little hug and kiss and nothing else happens. Just keep me warm for the night. Just hold on to each other when times are hard, times are rough. And I'd say, fuck, why are you bothering with me when you know I'm an asshole and I'll be gone tomorrow? I don't know, I guess you're worth it. Well, I'm not going to argue. The first time I encountered that was with these little English chicks up in the north on that first tour. You end up after the show at a pub or the bar of the hotel, and suddenly you're in the room with some very sweet chick who's going to Sheffield University and studying sociology who decides to be really nice to you. I thought you were a smart chick. I'm a guitar player. I'm just going through town. Yeah, but I like you. Liking is sometimes better than loving. By the late 50s, teenagers were a targeted new market, an advertising wind-up. Teenager comes from advertising. It's quite cold-blooded. Calling them teenagers created a whole thing amongst teenagers themselves, a self-consciousness. It created a market not just for clothes and cosmetics, but also for music and literature and everything else. It put that age group in a separate bag, and there was an explosion, a big hatch of pubescence around that time, Beatlemania and Stone Mania. These were chicks that were just dying for something else. Four or five skinny blokes provided the outlet, but they would have found it somewhere else. The power of teenage females of 13, 14, 15, when they're in a gang, has never left me. They nearly killed me. I was never more in fear for my life than I was from teenage girls. The ones that choked me, tore me to shreds, if you got caught in a frenzied crowd of them, it's hard to express how frightening they could be. You'd rather be in a trench fighting the enemy than to be faced with this unstoppable killer wave of lust and desire, or whatever it is. It's unknown even to them. The cops are running away, and you're faced with this frenzy of unleashed emotions. I think it was Middlesbrough, and I couldn't get in the car. It was an Austin Princess, and I'm trying to get in the car, and these bitches are ripping me apart. The problem is, if they get their hands on you, they don't know what to do with you. They nearly strangled me with a necklace. One grabbed one side of it, the other grabbed the other, and they're going, Keith, Keith. Meanwhile, they're choking me. I get hold of the handle, and it comes off in my hand, and the car goes zooming off, and I'm left with this goddamn handle in my hand. I got left in the lurch that day. The driver panicked. The rest of the guys had gotten in the car, and he just wasn't going to stick around any longer. So I was left in this pack of female hyenas. Next thing, I woke up in this back alley stage door entrance, because the cops had obviously moved everyone on. I'd passed out. I'd suffocated. They were all over me. What are you going to do with me now you've got me? I remember one scene of real contact with these girls, a completely unexpected moment, a vignette. The sky is sullen. It's a day off. Suddenly, the storm breaks viciously. Outside, I see three diehard fans. Their bouffants are succumbing to nature's forces, but they stay. What can a poor boy do? Get in here, dopes. My tiny cubicle is filled with three drowned brats. They steam, trembling. They drench my room. The hairdos are done. They are trembling from the storm, and from suddenly being in their, or one of their, idol's room. Confusion reigns. They don't know whether to squat or go blind. I'm equally confused. It's one thing to play on stage to them. It's another to be face to face. Towels become an important issue, as does the John. They make a poor attempt to resurrect themselves. It's all nerves and tension. I get them some coffee, laced with a little bourbon. But sex is not even in the air. We sit and talk and laugh until the sky clears. I get them a cab. We part as friends. September 1963. No songs. At least none that we thought would make the charts. Nothing in the ever-depleting R&B barrel looked likely. We were rehearsing at Studio 51 near Soho. Andrew had disappeared to walk about and absent himself from this gloom, and he'd walked into John and Paul, getting out of a taxi in the Charing Cross Road. They had a drink, and they detected Andrew's distress. He told them, no songs. They came back to the studio with him and gave us a song that was on their next album, but wasn't coming out as a single. I Want to Be Your Man. They played it through with us. Brian put on some nice slide guitar. We turned it into an unmistakably Stones rather than Beatles song. It was clear that we had a hit, almost before they left the studio. They deliberately aimed it at us. They're songwriters. They're trying to flog their songs. It's Tin Pan Alley. And they thought this song would suit us. And also, we were a mutual admiration society. Mick and I admired their harmonies and their songwriting capabilities. They envied us our freedom of movement and our image. And they wanted to join in with us. The thing is, with the Beatles and us, it was a very friendly relationship. It was also very cannily worked out, because in those days, singles were coming out every 6-8 weeks. And we'd try and time it so that we didn't clash. I remember John Lennon calling me up and saying, "Well, we've not finished mixing yet. We've got one ready to go. Okay, you go first." When we first took off, we were too busy playing on the road to think about writing songs. Also, we reckoned it wasn't our job. It hadn't occurred to us. Mick and I considered songwriting to be some foreign job that somebody else did. I rode the horse and somebody else put the shoes on. Our first records were all covers. Come On, Poison Ivy, Not Fade Away. We were just playing American music to English people, and we could play it damn good, and some American people even heard. We were already shocked and stunned to be where we were, and we were very happy as interpreters of the music that we loved. We thought we had no reason to step outside. But Andrew was persistent, strictly pressure of business. You've got an incredible thing going here, but without more material, and preferably new material, it's over. You've got to find out if you can do that, and if not, then we've got to find some writers. Because you can't just live off cover versions. That quantum leap into making our own material, that took months. Though I found it a lot easier than I expected. The famous day when Andrew locked us in a kitchen up in Willesden and said, "Come out with a song." That did happen. Why Andrew put Mick and me together as songwriters and not Mick and Brian or me and Brian, I don't know. It turned out that Brian couldn't write songs, but Andrew didn't know that then. I guess it's because Mick and I were hanging out together at the time. Andrew puts it this way. I worked on the assumption that if Mick could write postcards to Chrissy Shrimpton and Keith could play a guitar, then they could write songs. We spent the whole night in that goddamn kitchen. And I mean, we're the Rolling Stones, like the Blues Kings. And we've got some food. Piss out the window or down the sink. It's no big deal. And I said, "If we want to get out of here, Mick, we better come up with something." We sat there in the kitchen and I started to pick away at these chords. "It is the evening of the day." I might have written that. "I sit and watch the children play." I certainly wouldn't have come up with that. We had two lines and an interesting chord sequence, and then something else took over somewhere in the process. I don't want to say mystical, but you can't put your finger on it. Once you've got that idea, The rest of it will come. It's like you've planted a seed, then you water it a bit, and suddenly it sticks up out of the ground and goes, hey, look at me. The mood is made somewhere in the song. Regret, lost love. Maybe one of us had just busted up with a girlfriend. If you can find the trigger that kicks off the idea, the rest of it is easy. It's just hitting the first spark. Where that comes from, God knows. With As Tears Go By, we weren't trying to write a commercial pop song. It was just what came out. I knew what Andrew wanted. Don't come out with the blues. Don't do some parody or copy. Come out with something of your own. A good pop song is not really that easy to write. It was a shock, this fresh world of writing our own material. This discovery that I had a gift I had no idea existed. It was Blake-like, a revelation, an epiphany. As Tears Go By was first recorded and made into a hit by Marianne Faithfull. That was only weeks away. After that, we wrote loads of airy-fairy silly love songs for chicks and stuff that didn't take off. We'd give them to Andrew, and amazing to us, he got most of them recorded by other artists. Mick and I refused to put this crap we were writing with the Stones. We'd have been laughed out of the goddamn room. Andrew was waiting for us to come up with The Last Time. Songwriting had to be fitted in. After a show was sometimes the only time. It was impossible on the road. Stu would drive us, and he was merciless. We'd be stuck in the back of this Volkswagen, sealed in, one window at the back. And you sat on the engine. Most important was the gear, the amplifiers and the microphone stands and the guitars. And then, once that was loaded, wedge yourselves in. Find some room. And if you wanted to stop for a pee, forget about it. He'd pretend he couldn't hear you. And he had a huge stereo. Mobile sounds 40 years ahead of what they've got now. Two huge JBLs next to his ears in his driving cabin. A traveling prison. The Ronettes were the hottest girl group in the world. And in early 1963, they'd just released one of the greatest songs ever recorded, Be My Baby, produced by Phil Spector. We toured with the Ronettes on our second UK tour, and I fell in love with Ronnie Bennett, the youngest of the trio, who was the lead singer. She was 20 years old, and she was extraordinary to hear, to look at, to be with. I fell in love with her, silently, and she fell in love with me. She was as shy as I was, so there wasn't a lot of communication. But there sure was love. It all had to be kept very quiet because Phil Spector was, and notoriously remained, a man of prodigious jealousy. She had to be in her room all the time in case Phil called. And I think he quickly got a whiff that Ronnie and I were getting on, and he would call people and tell them to stop Ronnie seeing anybody after the show. Mick had cottoned to her sister, Estelle, who was not so tightly chaperoned. They came from a huge family. Their mother, who had six sisters and seven brothers, lived in Spanish Harlem, and Ronnie had first stepped out onto the Apollo stage when she was 11 years old. She told me later that Phil was acutely conscious of his receding hairline and couldn't stand my abundant barnet, London rhyming slang for hair, Barnet Fair. This insecurity was so chronic that he would go to terrible lengths to allay his fears, to the point where, after he married Ronnie in 1968, he made her prisoner in his California mansion, barely allowing her out and preventing her from singing, recording, or touring. In her book, she describes Phil taking her to the basement and showing her a gold coffin with a glass top, warning her that this was where she would be on display if she strayed from his rigorous rules. Ronnie had a lot of guts at that young age, which didn't, however, get her out of Phil's grip. I remember watching Ronnie do a vocal at Gold Star Studios. Shut up, Phil, I know how it should go. Ronnie remembered how we were on that tour together. Ronnie Spector. Keith and I made ways to be together. I remember on that tour in England, there was so much fog that the bus had to actually stop. And Keith and I got out, and we went over to this little cottage, and this old lady came to the door, sort of heavy and so sweet. And I said, "Hi, I'm Ronnie of the Ronettes." And Keith said, "I'm Keith Richards of the Rolling Stones, and we can't move our bus because we can't see any farther than our hands." So she says, "Oh, come on in, kids, I'll give you something." And she gave us scones, tea. Then she gave us extra ones to bring back to the bus, and to be honest, those were the happiest days of my entire career. We were 20 years old, and we just fell in love. What do you do when you hear a record like Be My Baby, and suddenly you are? But same old story. Can't let anybody else know. So it was a terrible thing in a way. But basically, it was just hormones and sympathy. Without us even thinking about it, we both realized that we were awash in this sea of sudden success and that other people were directing us and we didn't like it. But nothing much you can do about it. Not on the road. But then, we would never have met if we had not been in this weird situation. Ronnie only wanted the best for people and never quite got the best for herself. But her heart was definitely in the right place. I went to the Strand Palace Hotel and looked her up early one morning. "Just want to say hello." The tour was about to leave for Manchester or somewhere. We had to all get on the bus, so I just figured I'd pick her up before. Nothing happened then. I just helped her to pack. But it was a very bold move for me because I'd never put the come on to any chick. We were reunited in New York not long after this, as I will tell. And I've always kept in touch with Ronnie. On the day of 9/11, we were recording together a song called Love Affair in New York. It is a work in progress. In the arrogance of youth, the idea of being a rock star or a pop star was taking a step down from being a blues man and playing the clubs. For us to have to dip our feet into commercialism in 1962 or 63 was for a small while distasteful. The Rolling Stones, when they started, the limits of their ambition was just to be the best fucking band in London. We disdained the provinces. It was a real London mindset. But once the world beckoned, it didn't take long for the scales to fall from the eyes. Suddenly the whole world was opening up. The Beatles were proving that. It's not that easy being famous. You don't want to be. But at the same time, you've got to be in order to do what you're doing. And you realize you've already made the deal at the crossroads. Nobody said this was the deal. But within a few weeks, months, you realize that you've made the deal. And that you are now set on a path that is not your aesthetically ideal path. Stupid teenage idealisms, purisms, bullshit. You're now set on the path, along with all those people that you wanted to follow anyway, like Muddy Waters, Robert Johnson. You've already made the fucking deal. And now, you have to follow it. Just like all your brothers and sisters and ancestors. You are now on the road.
Chapter 5. The Stones' first tour of the USA. Meeting Bobby Keys at the San Antonio State Fair. Chess Records, Chicago. I hook up with the future Ronnie Spector and go to the Apollo in Harlem. Fleet Street and Andrew Oldham provide our new popular image. Long-haired, obnoxious, and dirty. Mick and I write a song we can give the Stones. We go to LA and record with Jack Nietzsche at RCA. I write Satisfaction in my sleep, and we have our first number one. Alan Klein becomes our manager. Linda Keith breaks my heart. I buy my country house, Redlands. Brian begins to melt down and meets Anita Pallenberg. The first time the Stones went to America, we felt we'd died and gone to heaven. It was the summer of 64. Everybody had their own little thing about America. Charlie would go down to the Metropole when it was still swinging, and see Eddie Condon. First thing I did was visit Colony Records and buy every Lenny Bruce album I could find. Yeah, I was amazed by how old-fashioned and European New York seemed. Quite different to what I'd imagined. Bellboys, maitre d's, all that sort of thing. Unnecessary fluff and very unexpected. It was as if somebody had said, these are the rules of 1920, and it hadn't changed a bit since. And on the other hand, it was the fastest-moving modern place you could be. And the radio! You couldn't believe it after England. Being there at a time of a real musical explosion, sitting in a car with the radio on, was beyond heaven. You could turn the channels and get 10 country stations, 5 black stations, and if you were travelling the country and they faded out, you just turn the dial again, and there was another great song. Black music was exploding. It was a powerhouse. In Motown, they had a factory, but without turning out automatons. We lived off Motown on the road, just waiting for the next Four Tops or the next Temptations. Motown was our food, on the road and off. Listening to car radios through 1,000 miles to get to the next gig. That was the beauty of America. We used to dream of it before we got there. I knew Lenny Bruce might not be every American's sense of humour, but I thought from there I could get a thread to the secrets of the culture. He was my entree into American satire. Lenny was the man. The sick humour of Lenny Bruce. I'd taken him in long before I got to America, so I was well prepared when on the Ed Sullivan Show Mick wasn't allowed to sing Let's Spend the Night Together. We had to sing Let's Spend Some Time Together. Talk about shades and nuances. What does that mean? Especially to CBS. A night is not allowed? Unbelievable. It used to make us laugh. It's pure Lenny Bruce. Titty is a dirty word? What's dirty? The word or the titty? Andrew and I walked into the Brill Building, the Tin Pan Alley of US Song, to try and see the great Jerry Lieber. But Jerry Lieber wouldn't see us. Someone recognized us and took us in and played us all these songs. And we walked out with Down Home Girl by Lieber and Butler, a great funk song that we recorded in November 1964. Looking for the Decca offices in New York on one of our ventures, we ended up in a motel on 26th and 10th with a drunken Irishman called Walt McGuire, a crew-cut guy who looked as if he'd just gotten out of the American Navy. This was the head of the U.S. Decca office. And we suddenly realized the great Decca Record Company was actually some warehouse in New York. It was a car trick. Oh, yes, we have big offices in New York. And it was down on the docks on the West Side Highway. We were listening to chick songs, doo-wop, Uptown Soul, the Marvelettes, the Crystals, the Chiffons, the Chantels, all of this stuff coming in our ears, and we're loving it. And the Ronettes, the hottest girl group around. Will You Love Me Tomorrow by the Shirelles. Shirley Owens, their lead singer, had an almost untrained voice, beautifully balanced with a fragility and simplicity, almost as if she wasn't a singer. All this stuff you heard, no doubt the Beatles had an effect. Please, Mr. Postman, and Twist and Shout by the Isley Brothers. If we tried to play anything like that down at the Richmond Station Hotel, it would have been, what? I've gone mad. Because they wanted to hear hard-duty Chicago blues that no other band could play as well as we could. The Beatles certainly could never have played it like that. At Richmond, it was our workmanlike duty not to stray from the path. The first show we ever did in America was at the Swing Auditorium in San Bernardino, California. Bobby Goldsborough, who taught me the Jimmy Reed lick, he was on the show and the Chiffons. But earlier, We'd had the experience of Dean Martin introducing us at the taping of the Hollywood Palace TV show. In America, then, if you had long hair, you were a faggot as well as a freak. They would shout across the street, "Hey, fairies!" Dean Martin introduced us as something like, "These long-haired wonders from England are Rolling Stones. They're backstage picking the fleas off each other." A lot of sarcasm and eyeball rolling. Then he said, "Don't leave me alone with this," gesturing with horror in our direction. This was Dino, the rebel rat packer who cocked his finger at the entertainment world by pretending to be drunk all the time. We were, in fact, quite stunned. English compares and showbiz types may have been hostile, but they didn't treat you like some dumb circus act. Before we'd gone on, he'd had the bouffanted King sisters and performing elephants standing on their hind legs. I love old Dino. He was a pretty funny bloke, even though he wasn't ready for the changing of the guard. On to Texas and more freak show appearances. In one case, with a pool of performing seals between us and the audience at the San Antonio, Texas State Fair. That was where I first met Bobby Keys, the great saxophone player, my closest pal. We were born within hours of each other. A soul of rock and roll, a solid man, also a depraved maniac. The other guy in that gig was George Jones. They trailed in with a tumbleweed following them, as if tumbleweed was their pet. Dust all over the place, bunch of cowboys. But when George got up, we went, "Whoa, there's a master up there." You have to ask Bobby Keys how big Texas is. It took me 30 years to convince him that Texas was actually just a huge land grab by Sam Houston and Stephen Austin. "No fucking way. How dare you?" He's red in the face. So I laid a few books on him about what actually happened between Texas and Mexico. And 6 months later, he says, "Your case seems to have some substance." "I know the feeling, Bob. I used to believe that Scotland Yard was lily white." But Bobby Keys should be allowed to tell the tale of our first meeting, since this is a Texan story. He flatters me, but in this case, I have allowed it. I first met Keith Richards physically in San Antonio, Texas. I was so biased against that man before I actually met him. They recorded a song, "Not Fade Away," by a guy named Buddy Holly, born in Lubbock, Texas, same as me. I said, "Hey, that was Buddy's song. Who are these pasty-faced, funny-talking, skinny-legged guys to come over here and cash in on Buddy's song? I'll kick their asses." I didn't care much for the Beatles. I kind of secretly liked them. But I saw the death of the saxophone unraveling before my eyes. "None of these guys have saxes in their bands, man. I'm going to be playing Tijuana brass shit for the rest of my life." I didn't think, "Great, we're going to be on the same show." I was playing with a guy named Bobby V, who had a hit at the time called "Rubber Ball." "I keep bouncing back to you." And we were headlining the show until they came on. And then they were headlining the show. And this was Texas, man. This was my stomping ground. We're all staying at the same hotel in San Antonio. And they were out on the balcony, Brian and Keith, and I think Mick. I went out and listened to them, and there was some actual rock and roll going on there, in my humble opinion. And of course I knew all about it, given it was invented in Texas and me being present at its birth. And the band was really, really good. And they did "Not Fade Away" actually better than Buddy ever did it. Now, I never said that to them or anybody else. I thought maybe I'd judge these guys too harshly. So the next day, we must have played 3 shows with them. And about the third time I was in the dressing room with them, they were all talking about the American acts, how before they went on stage, they all changed clothes, which we did. We went on with our black mohair suits and white shirts and ties, which was stupid, because it's 900 degrees outside, summertime in San Antonio. And they were saying, why don't we ever change clothes? And they said, yeah, that's a good idea. I'm expecting them to whip out some suits and ties, but they just change clothes with each other. I thought that was great. You gotta realize that the vision, the image, according to 1964 U.S. rock and roll standards, was mohair suit and tie and nicey-nicey old boy next door. And all of a sudden, here comes his truckload of English jackflies, interlopers, singing a Buddy Holly song. Damn! I couldn't really hear all that well, amplifiers and PAs being what they were, but man, I felt it. I just fucking felt it. And it made me smile and dance. They didn't dress alike, they didn't do sets. They just broke all the fucking rules and made it work. And that is what enchanted the shit out of me. So, being inspired by this, the next day, I got my mohair suit out and put the trousers on, and my toenail split the seam down the front. And I didn't have anything else to wear. So I wore my shirt and tie and put on Bermuda shorts and cowboy boots. I didn't get fired. I got, what are you? How dare? What is fucking going on, man? It redefined a lot of stuff for me. The American music scene, the whole set of teenage idols and clean-cut boys from next door and nice little songs, all that went right out the fucking window when these guys showed up. Along with the press. Would you let your daughter? All that stuff. Forbidden fruit. Anyway, somehow they noticed what I did, and I noticed what they did. And we just kind of met there. Really just brushed paths. And then I ran into them again. When they were doing the TAMI show. I discovered that Keith and I had the same birthday, both born 12/18/43. He told me, Bubby, you know what that means. We're half man and half horse, and we got a license to shit in the streets. Well, that's just one of the greatest pieces of information I have received in my life. The whole heart and soul of this band is Keith and Charlie. I mean, that's apparent to anybody who's breathing or has a musical bone in his body. That is where the engine room is. I'm not a school musician. I can't read music. I never had any professional training. But I can feel stuff. And when I heard him playing guitar, it reminded me so much of the energy I heard from Buddy and I heard from Elvis. There was something there that was the real deal. Even though he was playing Chuck Berry, it was still the real deal, you know? And I'd heard some pretty good guitar players coming out of Lubbock. Orbison came from Vernon, a few hours away. I used to listen to him and Buddy at the skating rink. And Scotty Moore and Elvis Presley would come through town. So I'd heard some pretty good guitar players. And there was just something about Keith that immediately reminded me of Holly. They're about the same size. Buddy was a skinny guy, had bad teeth. Keith was a mess. But some folks, they just got a look in their eye. And he looked dangerous, and that's the truth. There was a stark thing he discovered about America. It was civilized around the edges, but 50 miles inland from any major American city, whether it was New York, Chicago, L.A., or Washington, you really did go into another world. In Nebraska and places like that, we got used to them saying, hello, girls. We just ignored it. At the same time, they felt threatened by us because their wives were looking at us and going, that's interesting. Not what they were used to every bloody day, not some beer-swilling redneck. Everything they said was offensive, but the actual drive behind it was very much defense. We just wanted to go in, have a pancake or a cup of coffee with some ham and eggs, but we had to be prepared to put up with some taunting. All we were doing was playing music, but what we realized was we were going through some very interesting social dilemmas and clashes. And whole loads of insecurities, it seemed to me. Americans were supposed to be brash and self-confident, bullshit. That's just a front. Especially the men. Especially in those days. They didn't know quite what was happening. Things did happen fast. I'm not surprised a few guys just couldn't get the spin on it. The only hostility I can recall on a consistent basis was from white people. Black brothers and musicians, at the very least, thought we were interestingly quirky. We could talk. It was far more difficult to break through to white people. You always got the impression that you were definitely a threat, and all you'd done was ask, "Can I use your bathroom? You a boy or a girl? What you gonna do? Pull your cock out?" Back in England, we had a number one album, but out in the middle of America, nobody knew who we were. They were more aware of the Dave Clark Five and the swinging blue jeans. In some towns, we got some real hostility, real killer looks in our direction. Sometimes we got the sense that an exemplary lesson was about to be taught us, right then and there. We'd have to make a quick getaway in our faithful station wagon with Bob Bonus, our road manager, great guy. He'd been on the road with Midgets, performing Monkeys, with some of the best acts of all time. He eased us into America, driving 500 miles a day. A lot of our gigs in 64, 65 were piggybacked onto these other tours that were already lined up. So for 2 weeks, we'd be with Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells, the Vibrations, and a contortionist called the Amazing Rubber Man. And then we'd switch on to another circuit. First time I ever saw anybody lip-sync on stage was the Shangri-Las. Remember, walking in the sand. Three New York chicks, and they're very handsome and everything like that. But you suddenly realize there's no band. They're actually singing to a tape machine. And they were the Green Men, also Ohio, I think. They actually painted themselves green to perform their duty. Whatever was the flavor of the week or the month, some of them were damn good players, especially in the Midwest and the Southwest. Those little bands playing any given night in bars, never going to make it, and they didn't even want to. That's the beauty of it. And some of them damn good pickers. Wealth of talent out there. Guys that could play much better than I could. Sometimes we were top of the bill. Not always, but usually. And with Patti LaBelle and the Bluebells, there was young Sarah Dash, who had this woman chaperone dressed in her Sunday church outfit. If you smiled, you got a glare. They used to call her Inch. She was sweet. In short, 20 years later, she'll be back in my story. And of course, beginning in 65, I'm starting to get stoned. A lifelong habit now. Which also intensified my impression of what was going on. Just smoking the weed at the time. The guys I met on the road were to me then older men in their 30s, some in their 40s, black bands that we were playing with. We'd be up all night. We'd get the gig, and everybody's brothers in their shark skin suits, the chain, the waistcoat, the hair gel, and they're all shaved and groomed, so fit and sweet, and we just drag our asses in. One day, I was feeling so ragged getting to the gig, and these brothers were so together, and shit, they were working the same schedule we were. So I said to one of these guys, a horn player, "Jesus, how do you look so good every day?" And he pulled his coat back, reached into his waistcoat pocket, and said, "You take one of these, you smoke one of those." Best bit of advice. He gave me a little white pill, a white cross, and a joint. This is how we do it. You take one of these, and you smoke one of those. But keep it dark. That was the line I left the room with. Now we've told you, keep it dark. And I felt like I'd just been let into a secret society. "Is it all right if I tell the other guys?" "Yeah, but keep it amongst yourselves. Backstage, it had been going on from time immemorial. The joint really got my attention. The joint got my attention so much that I forgot to take the Benzedrine. They made good speed in those days. Oh, yeah, it was pure. You could get hold of speed at any truck stop. Truck drivers relied upon it. Stop over here, pull over to some truck stop and ask for Dave. Give me a Jack Daniels on the rocks and a bag. Give me a pig foot and a bottle of beer. ''2120 South Michigan Avenue was hallowed ground, the headquarters of Chess Records in Chicago. We got there in a last-minute arrangement made by Andrew Oldham, at a moment when the first half of our first US tour seemed like a semi-disaster. There, in the perfect sound studio, in the room where everything we'd listened to was made, perhaps out of relief or just the fact that people like Buddy Guy, Chuck Berry and Willie Dixon were wandering in and out, we recorded 14 tracks in 2 days. One of them was Bobby Womack's It's All Over Now, our first number one hit. Some people, Marshall Chess included, swear that I made this up. But Bill Wyman can back me up. We walked into Chess Studios, and there's this guy in black overalls painting the ceiling. And it's Muddy Waters. And he's got whitewash streaming down his face, and he's on top of a ladder. Marshall Chess says, oh, we never had him painting. But Marshall was a boy then. He was working in the basement. And also Bill Wyman told me he actually remembers Muddy Waters taking our amplifiers from the car into the studio. Whether he was being a nice guy or he wasn't selling records then, I know what the Chess Brothers were bloody well like. If you want to stay on a payroll, get to work. Actually meeting your heroes, your idols. The weirdest thing is that most of them are so humble and very encouraging. Play that lick again, and you realise you're sitting with Muddy Waters. And of course, later I got to know him. Over many years, I frequently stayed at his house. In those early trips, I think it was Alan Wolfe's house I stayed at one night, but Muddy was there, sitting in the south side of Chicago with these two greats. And the family life, loads of kids and relatives walking in and out. Willie Dixon was there. In America, people like Bobby Womack used to say, first time we heard you guys, we thought you were black guys. Where'd these motherfuckers come from? I can't figure that out myself. Why Mick and I and that damn town should come up with such a sound. Except that if you soak it up in a damp tenement in London all day with the intensity that we did, it ain't that different from soaking it up in Chicago. That's all we played until we actually became it. We didn't sound English, and I think that surprised us too. Each time we played, and I still do this at certain times, I just turn around and say, is that noise just coming from him, there, and me? It's almost as if you're riding a wild horse. In that respect, we're damn lucky we got to work with Charlie Watts. He was playing very much like black drummers, playing with Sam, Dave and a Motown stuff, or the soul drummers. He has that touch. A lot of the time, very correct, with the sticks through the fingers, which is how most drummers now play. If you try to get savage, you're off. It's a bit like surfing. It's okay while you're out there. And because of that style of Charlie's, I could play the same way. One thing drives another in a band. It all has to melt together. Basically, it's all liquid. The most bizarre part of the whole story is that having done what we intended to do in our narrow, purest teenage brains at the time, which was to turn people on to the blues, what actually happened was we turned American people back on to their own music. And that's probably our greatest contribution to music. we turned white America's brain and ears around. I wouldn't say we were the only ones. Without the Beatles, probably nobody would have broken the door down. And they certainly weren't blues men. American black music was going along like an express train. But white cats, after Buddy Holly died and Eddie Cochran died, and Elvis was in the army gone wonky, white American music when I arrived was the Beach Boys and Bobby V. It was still stuck in the past. And the past was just 6 months ago. It wasn't a long time, but shit changed. The Beatles were the milestone, and then they got stuck inside their own cage, the Fab Four. Hence, eventually, you got the Monkees, all this ersatz shit. But I think there was a vacuum somewhere in white American music at the time. When we first got to America and to LA, there was a lot of Beach Boys on the radio, which is pretty funny to us. It was before Pet Sounds. It was hot rod songs and surfing songs, pretty lousily played, familiar Chuck Berry licks going on. Round, round, get round, I get round. I thought that was brilliant. It was later on listening to Pet Sounds. Well, it's all a little bit overproduced for me, but Brian Wilson had something. In My Room, Don't Worry, Baby. I was more interested in their B-sides, the ones he slipped in. There was no particular correlation with what we were doing, so I could just listen to it on another level. I thought, these are very well-constructed songs. I took easily to the pop song idiom. I'd always listen to everything. And America opened it all out. We were hearing records there that were regional hits. We get to know local labels and local acts, which is how we came across Time Is On My Side in L.A., sung by Irma Thomas. It was a B-side of a record on Imperial Records, a label we'd been made aware of because it was independent and successful and based on Sunset Strip. I've talked to guys since, like Joe Walsh of the Eagles and many other white musicians, about what they listened to when they were growing up. And it was all very provincial and narrow and depended on the local, usually white, FM radio station. Bobby Keys, he reckons he can tell where someone come from by their musical tastes. Joe Walsh heard us play when he was at high school. And he's told me that it had a huge effect on him simply because nobody he knew had ever heard anything like that because there wasn't anything. He was listening to doo-wop, and that was about it. He had never heard Muddy Waters. Amazingly, he was first exposed to the blues, he said, by hearing us. He also decided there and then that the minstrel's life was for him. Now you can't go into any diner without hearing him weave in that guitar of his on Hotel California. Jim Dickinson, the Southern boy, who played piano on Wild Horses, was exposed to black music through the powerful and only black radio station, WDIA, when he was growing up in Memphis. So when he went to college in Texas, he had a musical education that exceeded that of anybody he met there. But he never saw any black musicians, even though he lived in Memphis, except once he saw the Memphis Jug Band with Will Shade and Good Kid on the washboard when they was playing in the street when he was 9. But the racial barriers were so severe that those kind of players were inaccessible to him. Then Furry Lewis, whose funeral he played, and Booker White and others were being brought out to play via the folk revival. I do think maybe the Stones had a lot to do with making people twiddle their knobs a little more. When we put out Little Red Rooster, a raw Willie Dixon blues with sly guitar and all, was a daring move at the time, November 1964. We were getting no-nos from the record company, management, and everyone else. But we felt we were on the crest of a wave and we could push it. It was almost in defiance of Pup. In our arrogance at the time, we wanted to make a statement. I am the little red rooster, too lazy to crow for day. See if you can get that to the top of the charts, motherfucker. Song of Bad Chicken. Mick and I stood up and said, come on, let's push it. This is what we're fucking about. And the floodgates burst after that. Suddenly, Muddy and Howlin' Wolf and Buddy Guy are getting gigs and working. It was a breakthrough, and the record got a number one. And I am absolutely sure what we were doing made Berry Gordy at Motown capable of pushing his stuff elsewhere. And it certainly rejuvenated Chicago blues as well. I keep a notebook where I write down sketches and song ideas, and it contains this. Juke joint. Alabama? Georgia? Finally, I'm in my element. An incredible band is wailing on a stage, decorated with phosphorescent paint. The dance floor is moving as one. So does the sweat and the ribs cooking out back. The only thing that makes me stand out is that I'm white. Wonderfully, no one notices this aberration. I am accepted. I'm made to feel so warm. I am in heaven. Most towns, like White Nashville, for example, by 10 o'clock were ghost towns. We were working with Black Guys, The Vibrations, Don Bradley, I think his name was. The most amazing act, they could do everything. They were doing somersaults while they were playing. What are you going to do after the show? This is already an invitation. So get in the cab and we go across the tracks and it's just starting to happen. There's food going, everybody's rocking and rolling. Everybody's having a good time. And it was such a contrast from the white side of town. Always sticks in my memory. You could hang there with ribs, drinks, smoke, and big mamas. For some reason, they always looked upon us as thin and frail people. So they started to mama us, which was all right with me. Shoved into the middle of two enormous breasts. You need a rub down, boy? Okay. Anything you say, Mama. Just the free and easiness of it. You wake up in a house full of black people who have been so incredibly kind to you, you can't believe it. I mean, shit, I wish this happened at home. And this happened in every town. You wake up, where am I? And there's a big mama there and you're in bed with her daughter, but you get breakfast in bed. The first time I stared into a gun barrel was in the men's room of the Civic Auditorium, I believe, in Omaha, Nebraska. It was in the fist of a big grizzled cop. I was with Brian backstage at soundcheck. We used to drink scotch and coke at the time. Anyway, we took our paper cups with us and answered the call of nature, cup in hand. Happily, we splashed away. I heard the door open behind us. Okay, turn around slowly, a voice wheezed. Fuck off, Brian said. I mean now came the wheeze. Shaking off the drips, we looked around. A massive cop with a huge revolver in his huge fist fixed us with a menacing regard. Silence ruled as Brian and I stared at the black hole. This is a public building. No alcoholic beverages allowed. You will tip the contents of your cups into the john. Now, no quick moves. Do it. Brian and I cracked up, but did as we were told. He did have the upper hand. Brian said something about heavy-handed overreaction, which only infuriated the old bugger, to the point that the barrel began to tremble. So we blabbered about being unaware of the city ordinance, to which he barked out something about ignorance not being a defense in the eyes of the law. I was about to ask how he knew we were drinking booze, but I thought better of it. We had another bottle in the dressing room. It was soon after that I picked up a Smith & Wesson 38 Special.